Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Welcome. This is Interpreter Radio. I'm Martin Tanner. Also in studio tonight, Dan Peterson, John Gee, Terry Hutchinson. We're here to have a great discussion about several topics. Gentlemen, welcome to KTalk Media Studios. It's a delight to have you all here.
Thank you.
Me too.
And the last Me Too, Terry Hutchinson. This is his first go-around here, but he is not a stranger to radio. So, Terry, why don't you take just a minute or two and tell our listeners who you are and why you're here.
My name's Terry Hutchinson. I have been doing radio in St. George, Utah for about the last 24 years. In fact, in December will be my 24th anniversary. I do a twice-daily book review show. Usually on Thursdays I like to do religious topics. Many of them are LDS books. I don't know if we can say that now, can we? We try. But also books from scholars of other faiths. And it's a more general listenership. So I have been a big fan of Mormon Interpreter ever since it was founded. And I've reviewed all the books that Interpreter has done and even some articles, mentioned them on the air, promoted them. I'm a big fan of work like that, and I think it can be accessible to just about anybody. So I live in St. George. I commute a lot. I'm actually doing a lot of work in northern Utah right now. I have a wife, Janae, from Alpine. Both our parents live in Alpine, and we have 5 kids and 6 grandkids.
Fabulous. Wonderful to have you here. And Dan Peterson needs no introduction, but I will say that he is the CEO of Mormon Interpreter and the founder, and is the one who was the impetus behind this whole idea. And of course, John Gee, who is the wonderful LDS Egyptologist.
Nice to be here.
Thank you. Wonderful to have you. The Interpreter Foundation is a foundation, nonprofit, 501c3. For those of you who wonder what in the world that means that if you want to contribute, hint, hint, to the Interpreter Foundation, that anything that you give is tax deductible. Mormon Interpreter is sponsored by the Interpreter Foundation. This radio show is of course, a Interpreter Foundation production, and the Interpreter Foundation has as its goals to foster study and scholarship and researching LDS topics and defending the faith and pushing back against all the critics. And if you do anything on the blogosphere or blogger knackle, as it is sometimes called, with respect to Mormon topics, you will see the work of many people who are part of the Interpreter Foundation.
Yeah, it's a great operation, a great organization to be involved with. And one of the things that we're wanting to do with it, one of the things that we're really well positioned to do now, is to get the information out to people all around the world. I mean, when I used to be involved with the old FARMS, Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies, one of the complaints that I heard, well, not so much a complaint, but a lament, I remember visiting with people in Perth, Western Australia, and they liked to laugh that they were as far from church headquarters as you could get without getting closer. Or they said, it's not the ends of the earth, but you can see the ends of the earth from here. But their complaint was, in Australia, for example, that any products that the old FARMS, which became the Maxwell Institute, produced were so expensive there, because if they printed books, first of all, it cost a lot to get them to Australia. It about doubled the cost. And then Australia apparently slaps on duties or tariffs on foreign books, so that the books would be 3 times as expensive in Australia as they would be in the States. So, you know, you buy a $10 book in Australia for $30 at that time. And the great thing about the way the Internet has developed since then is when we publish an article in Interpreter on Friday, it's as accessible to someone in Perth as it is to somebody in Provo, and at exactly the same cost, which is nothing. And so we do hope, and I appreciated that hint, that people who've been enjoying it for a while will contribute. Because I say we charge nothing, but producing these things doesn't cost nothing.
We are trying not to turn this into a telethon or a radiothon, though. So
that's
we
true.
Do hope to be talking about some other topics rather than fundraising.
Just for the first couple of minutes here, we do the fundraising pitch. And after that, we have four specific topics that we have on the slate here. The first one is that we're going to talk about the newly released Saints publication from the church. As I understand it, the first of four volumes. We're intending also to talk a bit about the Book of Abraham and how John Gee's book has been treated on the internet, and how the Book of Abraham in general is being treated on the internet, because they're, you know, of all the critical issues, that's the one that seems to me to be one of the very most misunderstood and abused. Our third topic that we had intended to discuss a bit is BYU's New Testament commentary. They have published now the Book of Revelation, the Gospel of Luke, and 1 Corinthians has just come out.
And Mark is coming out soon.
Yeah.
Is it Mark?
Mark is coming out. There are preview
and when we say Mark's coming out, that's different from the colloquial today, somebody coming out.
Oh, no, yeah. The commentary on Mark will soon appear.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's
I don't know what the publication schedule is on that and whether they're going to do it electronically or by print the way they've done the others. But Julie Smith is the author of this one. And right now it looks like it's going to be about 940 pages, even though Mark is the shortest of the four Gospels. And I'll just tell you, the introduction so far is phenomenal.
And it hopefully will appear in print by the end of the year.
Nice. Mark has always been my favorite Gospel because it makes Jesus the most human, and it's written in the most colloquial, you know, down-to-earth style. My own interests really lie in the Book of Mark, so I'm looking forward to that one. Thank you. I did not know that was on its way out. And the fourth topic was we were going to talk about the Expanded Canon, the new book, which is out from Greg Cofford Books, that has some essays that are, well, they all really deal with LDS issues, and some of them are, shall we say, a little bit more faithful than others, but they're all fascinating. At least I think most of them are really quite good. The only one that has a few logical issues, in my personal private opinion, is the gold plates one.
Right.
I'll just leave it there.
And tapes. Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't going to mention the name, but and tapes. So yeah, anyway, that one.
It does create some really interesting questions.
It does have a logically incoherent position on the topic.
That was my take. Thank you, John, for affirming that I hadn't, you know, had a mini stroke or something there. So shall we jump into the first topic? Who's taking a look at Saints and has an opinion about it, or some thoughts or ideas about why people ought to read it, or things you think should have been done that maybe could be incorporated in the future?
I wanted to talk about it from a general reader perspective. I mean, I'm sitting between Dr. Peterson and Dr. Gee.
Professor Peterson and Professor
Gee. Exactly, full professors.
Doctors,
yes,
professors,
whatever you want to call them. Yeah. And I have my own profession.
Professor Doctor. Yeah.
I have Professor Doctor.
Yes. But, you know, my listeners, and I've been talking to them for quite a while about this project, and we're super excited that it's come out. They talked about it for quite a while on our interpreter radio last week because it was coming, and we knew some of it, and about eight chapters had been released in the Ensign. But now the full book is out, and this is a big deal. I mean, first of all, it has a preface from the First Presidency, and they say specifically, we encourage people to read this, we encourage the members to read it, and to access the supplementary material. Now, it's sold in print for those who don't really have access to the internet or something, and it's $5.75. The book itself is 700 pages. So that's less than a penny a page. That's not even the cost of printing. So the church has got quite a financial investment just in that alone. But on top of that, the electronic version has links and hyperlinks to the references. So normally when you read a book, like when you're reading the print version of Saints, you'll look at the footnote and it will take you to the item in the Joseph Smith papers or whatever and tell you what page, what volume, etc. If you have the hyperlink on your Gospel Library app or on your tablet or however else you're following it, and I haven't tested the Kindle app yet, and by the way, Kindle is free, Nook is free, every e-reader version is free, Deseret News is free, the church is just giving it away, just like they do with the Book of Mormon. So you can go there and it will take you directly to the Joseph Smith Papers website and directly to the transcript of the papers, and with another little switch of your phone, you can look at the document itself that's being quoted. Now, they also made this, and this is something that was pointed out last week on Interpreter Radio, the church isn't just putting it out in English and then Spanish and then let it drift to the other languages. It's in all the major church languages immediately. To me, I think that's a big deal. The church has decided it's time for us to get on top of our history even more than even the gospel topics. So what they're doing, in fact, Elder Cook, right before we came on the air, was doing a face-to-face with young adults from Nauvoo, and he was talking about this book. And it's written in a narrative style that is very easy to read. It's captivating. It's simple. It's straightforward. And it provides an interest. So not only do they talk about the big names that everybody knows, Joseph and Brigham, but it talks about the regular members too and some of their experiences. And it deals with some of the harder topics as well. So for that reason, this is something that I'm promoting, and I think it's just a fantastic opportunity. I think everybody who is interested in Mormon history, member or not, should read it.
Yeah, I thought that the publication in multiple languages, was it 14, I think, languages simultaneously, is a really important message from the church to say, look, you non-English speakers are not just going to get crumbs from the table with this. It's coming out the same day it comes out for the English-speaking members of the church. It's coming out for you Portuguese and Spanish and Chinese-speaking members of the church, too. You're not second-class citizens. And between those 14 languages, I'm guessing you've probably got about, 85-90% of the church membership covered. And even people who don't speak any of those languages natively, say they're Dutch or Swedish or something, they'll almost always know English well or some one of those languages reasonably well.
Exactly so. And one of the other great things about this is that the language is extremely understandable. I believe that is the key feature. When the original history of the church, the official Joseph Smith history, came out, I don't remember what year it was, somebody here might, but they...
The 1842 or the...
The one in... No.
Or the night around 1930.
The 1930-ish one.
The comprehensive history.
The comprehensive. They published, I think, 10,000 copies, and it took an embarrassingly long time for those to sell out. They just didn't sell. And the reason was because that was not readable. It's not that Latter-day Saints were not interested in church history. It was just that somehow it was not readable. And this solves that problem. I love the links. I love the original source material that you can find. But to me, the simple readability, anybody who wants to read church history, there it is, the end of our segment, which we were all sort of thinking was going to happen about a minute and a half ago, but that's all right. What do we know? We'll be right back. This is the Interpreter Radio Show. I'm Martin Tanner with Dan Peterson, John Key, and Terry Hutchinson. We'll be right back. All right, we are back. And, of course, religiously appropriate bumper music brings us back. This is the Interpreter Radio Show. Terry Hutchinson, John Gee, Dan Peterson, and me, Martin Tanner. In studio, if you have a question or comment, if you'd like to join us to talk to two PhD professors and a couple of guys who are just kind of hanging along for the ride, you're welcome to give us a call. Two radio talk show hosts who pretend to know things and two PhDs who actually do. Give us a call. 801-254-1640 is the number. 801-254-1640 is the number. And I'm only teasing. Terry's, I have heard some of your reviews and things, and you do a fabulous job. I'm just
thank you.
Tossing in a little self-deprecation there that I should not have included you in. But back to
our
topic.
We were talking right before we went on the air about the kind of the documentary nature about the history of the church, the first one. And you know, that reminds me of something about the Joseph Smith papers. Your typical volume of the founding fathers' papers, like Washington or Hamilton, usually sells about 1,500 copies. I understand that the first print of the Joseph Smith papers, the first volume, was 10,000, and they sold it out. So I think that there is a great interest, at least among members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, we've covered that base now, to get their history and learn it for themselves. And it's taken me a while to learn to read the Joseph Smith papers because it's a documentary volume. This is a narrative. I mean, right out of the gate in Chapter 1, it talks about the volcanic explosion in 1815. Now, that's described and cited to a book called The Year Without a Summer that came out a few years ago. And that book, which was totally unrelated to the LDS Church, mentioned the fact that year without a summer, because of the volcanic ash in the atmosphere, it caused changes in the temperature that were so severe, the growing pattern that was normally 126 days was shortened to 62 days. And it caused the farm in Vermont owned by Joseph Smith Sr. to fail, and that caused him to relocate to New York, where Joseph was exposed to the religious revivals and eventually led to the first vision. And that's pointed out here in Saints. In a very, just within a few paragraphs, it's able to make that claim and make that statement and back it up, all in a very smooth fashion that's very readable. And then they go on and talk about some other things. And John and I were talking before we came on the air about, you know, some of the mentions of this that hadn't really been able to be brought up because the book wasn't in full, and now it's been released in full, so we can talk about everything that's in it.
The narrative flows really well, and so kudos to the committee that wrote it. It's a readable history, which many technical history works aren't, and which unfortunately the documentary history of the church is a magnificent compilation. It would include the entire source material on a lot of the things that they discussed. If there was a letter, they would cite the whole letter, which is a great resource, but unfortunately is not a great read. And Saints avoids that problem by giving it making it a good read.
Well, one of the ways they did it, and I was fascinated to learn about the process, was that they not only had a team of historians writing it, and you know the team of historians signs off on it to make sure it's accurate, but they also had a team of writers, people with English degrees, people who are involved in creative writing, who've written fiction, novels, whose specialty is narrative.
Storytelling.
Storytelling, yeah, to make sure that it reads well. And it does. It really flows extremely well. It's not difficult academies. You know, many academics, frankly, don't write all that well. And academic prose can be painful. But this is written in a way that's academically sound, but with a kind of novelist's flair. I don't want to overdo that. I don't want people to think this is fiction or that it's untrue. But it's a mix of the best of both.
In some ways, it goes back all the way to ancient historiography, where, and you see this in the Bible, where they tell the story and they tell it accurately and they're telling history, but they're bringing the whole craft of their use of the language and the use of language devices into the telling of the story. Unfortunately, with the Bible, almost all of that disappears in translation. But it's that sort of thing. It's well written in the language as well as accurate in the history.
Yeah, you have one of the great examples of that in historical writing is Edward Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, which is not only a great history of the Roman Empire, but it's incredibly quotable. He was just a really, really good writer.
The saints, the only downside to it that I can think of is that when I was getting out my felt tip and writing in the margins and then realized it was on my computer screen, you know, I had to get out the Windex. The writing in the margins, for those who used to do that, you know, that's kind of out. But otherwise, it's absolutely fabulous.
Well, it's less than $10, so you can afford to get a hard copy.
The hard copy as
well. And even though it's available electronically, most people prefer to actually read, if they're going to read something substantial, prefer to read it in hard copy and not on a computer screen. And it's great because you have the best of both worlds here. You have the electronic one available, and you have a reasonably priced hard copy.
But the binding is a problem, because if you spend very much time with that paperback binding, it gets beat up pretty quick.
It's so thick. It's just probably not going to last very long. I'm being really careful with mine, but I can't imagine it's going to survive many years.
I wish they had a hardbound.
Yeah.
They'll get there, I think, eventually. I think that'll come. This was more get it out there, make it available to everybody. And normally I would agree with these two that I like a paper copy, especially when I'm reading the scriptures or when I'm reading some other technical material. But for some reason, this one, I prefer the electronic. And I think it's aimed for the generation that is electronic, especially, just like I said, Elder Cook is right. If he's not done yet, he did right before we came on the air, a face-to-face with young adults, and that whole generation, everything's in their phone.
That's exactly right. One of my favorite little visual cartoons, I can't remember if it's a Larson or who did it, but it's got this grandfatherly looking guy, you know, holding hands with his little 6-year-old grandson, and he's walking him through a library, and the kid's obviously never been in a library before and saying, "What is this place?" Said, "Well, just think about it, is like the internet, but somebody put it on a whole bunch of paper." and you know, it's kind of the reverse thinking that will draw the youth into it, the very thinking of the little kid in this cartoon. That's the generation in which they're growing up. I mean, how revolutionary was it when, you know, you changed from scrolls to codices? You know, you had these, wow, this is really cool. You know, you turn the page. You don't have to roll through the whole scroll to get from the beginning to the end. You can just, like, flip these over. And this is like a major technological advance, and here we are now. The young guys have a huge thing.
And it still took about 150 years to make that transition between scroll to codex.
Yeah. I remember a fake ad I saw somewhere for something called a bio-optical knowledge system. And they were boasting that it didn't need an external power source and so on and so forth. And of course, the acronym is books.
There you go.
I think I'm 150 years behind on my technology. When I have a problem, I have to get my teenage daughter to help me, or my kids, even my grandkids.
That makes you like all the rest of us. Other comments on the Saints publication before we...
Well, I just wanted to say one other thing.
Please.
Because one of the things that I was curious about and hope that John might comment a little on is its treatment of the Book of Abraham or of the early Book of Mormon. They tell the story, and I was fascinated because they do this in the same chapter in Nauvoo, chapter 37, where they introduce polygamy to the people of Nauvoo. And this book deals with that very frankly, very openly, talks about those who accepted it, talks about those who didn't, and even some of the challenges that people raise with Joseph Smith, with women who were married to other men who he had proposed a plural marriage arrangement with, and they just are very frank in how they deal with that. And that was something that was very impressive to me, because in the past, that's always, while it's never been hidden, so to speak, it's never really been included in the official church materials either.
Very, very true. And for those who are not familiar with John Gee, he is a Latter-day Saint. See, I can't say Mormon Egyptologist anymore. That would just be a no-no. He's an Egyptologist who's a good and faithful member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and the world's foremost expert on the Book of Abraham. I can say that. He would never quite toot his own horn that way, even though he certainly is. And so if you have a question about the Book of Abraham, this is the show to call, and this is the hour to call it. Give us a call, 801-254-1640. And, John, you had a comment here.
Okay, so Terry brought up, you know, how does it treat the Book of Abraham? I was actually fairly pleased with the way that Saints dealt with the issue. You're not going to find a lot in there. But they avoided some pitfalls. And although I kind of hate to mention this, but the treatment of the Book of Abraham in, say, Rough Stone Rolling is very disappointing. It's hard to find anything that Richard Bushman got right on the topic. And his very short introduction to Mormonism is much worse on Book of Abraham. You should sort of black out anything that he says because it's all wrong. Saints doesn't have that problem. I didn't find any fault statements or problematic statements on the Book of Abraham. Book of Mormon is actually quite interesting in Saints, because there are some aspects in the Book of Mormon. If you up on the discussion of the coming forth of the Book of Mormon, there won't be any surprises in Saints. But if you're not, there might be. So it's very frank about Joseph Smith's use of seer stones, his involvement in money digging and how that figures in. It's handled very well. And they didn't shy away from it all. It's very matter of fact, and it's all in there. As I say, if you haven't kept up on that, you might have a few twists in the story that you didn't know about in Saints. If you've just been immersed in all of that stuff, maybe you won't find something new. But I think for most people in the church, the coming forth of the Book of Mormon has a few new twists in Saints.
Any other final copies on or comments on Saints?
Well, the only other thing I was going to say is that this is amazing. Just a few years ago, we would not be having this discussion about a publication put out by the church and particularly emphasized by the First Presidency. It is a total transparency and a change, a sea change in our history. I mean, we see that a couple of weeks ago they released the Wilford Woodruff journals online. Well, they've already released two things that I think I've always felt were kind of like, when it comes to church history, Mormon history, for lack of a better word, Indiana Jones type stuff. The Council of 50 Minutes, the diaries of George Q. Cannon, his journals, those were all withheld. And so there was just so much speculation about what might be in there. You might think you need to get it out of the vault by means of Indiana Jones and have little darts shooting at you and a boulder rolling down and everything else. And yet here we are. It's all there. It's all matter of fact. And as they say, sunlight is the best disinfectant. We all see now what everything was about, and we can have full and frank discussions about it, and we can get to the real heart and the real important issues. And for me, because of its readability and because of its availability, that's where Saints is really going to come into play. I don't know that we'll use it a lot in lessons or anything else, but I'm a big proponent of it, even though it's a fairly simple way of treating things.
I wouldn't be surprised if it does show up in lessons, and it's encouraged to do that. One of the other things that we should also mention before we go is that this is volume one of a projected four, which are already mostly done, if not done, and they will cover church history up into probably well into my lifetime, and I think I'm the youngest one here. So this is a full church history, unlike the documentary history of the church, which stopped about the time that the saints moved west. So this is, it's going to cover the whole sweep of church history, and I think that's exciting in its own way.
The other thing that I think is going to be revolutionarily different about this history is that it includes people, as we've already mentioned, ordinary members of the church, but it's also going to have an international focus as it comes into the more modern period and the church expands. And in the past, and this was true not just of Mormon history, this was what was traditionally done in history elsewhere. You had institutional histories. It was the big man theory of history. So, you know, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and so on. But more and more you get histories of the ordinary Revolutionary War soldier, or, you know, with Ken Burns' documentary on the Civil War. What was the experience like for a typical Confederate soldier, a typical Union soldier? And it turns out that's very, very interesting. And likewise with this, we're getting ordinary members, and we're going to get them, I think, in volumes 2, 3, and 4, increasingly overseas. What was it like to be an early English Latter-day Saint? What's it like to be a Latin American Latter-day Saint? What happened there? And I have a friend who's serving a mission in Salt Lake whose job is to write up short country histories. And he says there's so much good stuff that he's been finding as he's going through it. He said there are things in some of these country histories that are the equal of anything in the early restoration history of the church in New York.
Outstanding. We'll be right back on the other side of this break with a few parting comments about saints. I'm Martin Tanner in studio with Terry Hutchinson, John Key, and Dan Peterson. Stay tuned. We are back. This is the Interpreter Radio Show. For those who are just joining us, the Interpreter Foundation sponsors this program. The Interpreter Radio Show, which you are listening to, and the foundation support Mormon LDS scholarship, defending the faith, and scholarship into LDS history, doctrine, and related items. The comment that I had about the Saints book is, and this is the only concern that I have about it, but it's an unavoidable concern. When you have something that comes out from the church, it will be looked at as completely accurate and authoritative. And my personal best guess is that as time goes on, there will probably be additional finds from documents from the times of the early LDS Church, which will probably show some of the little details to be inaccurate. And off the air, we were talking about different historical issues and the difficulty people have in pinning them down. If you take a look, for example, at David Whitmer's recollections about early church history, you'll find that they're just an irreconcilable timeline. You know, you just can't make everything fit in with other known histories and other known dates, and so you run into some real, true, genuine limitations, and those are going to be inherent in this Saints volume as well. There will be things that are just not accurate in there, the same way there are things that are just flat out not accurate in the official history of the church, and hopefully they can be weeded out over time.
But I think we can give them the benefit of the doubt, because where there are problems, these are usually known problems, and the solution that they've come up with, from what I've read, has been eminently reasonable. And so I'm hoping that this one will age fairly well.
Which, I agree with that.
The most you can ask of historians is they do the story as well as they can at the point that they're writing. I mean, there will always be new interpretations and maybe new documentary evidence. We might discover something that settles this question or unsettles that question, but you know, you do the best you can. The only person who has a fully accurate view of history is God.
That's exactly right. I occasionally will go back to this phrase, which is, it's Catholic doctrine that the Pope is infallible and no Catholics believe it. And it's Mormon doctrine that its leaders are fallible, aren't absolutely perfect, but no Mormons believe it. And in some ways that may be the problem with saints over time, but it is that it's seen as absolutely perfect. And then if a flaw pops up, you've got a problem. But I agree with John and with Dan that this is an absolutely superb volume and will age well.
As somebody who's written some academic and some history books, the best that you want to hope for is that it's not going to go out of date in the next 5 years. I think saints will probably do that.
No danger of that.
Yeah. I think what they've got is everything that's in there is based upon everything they've currently got. I don't think that if something comes up, it'll be because there's a new discovery or perhaps a new interpretation of something based on some other discoveries, but it's not going to be something that they did that was just going to be later shown to be wrong. The documents back that up pretty clearly, and even in the narrative, they made sure that they stressed with the writing committee that it was, if you say that so-and-so blinked or something, you need to have a diary reference for that. So it's pretty close and accurate there.
It's done really well. See, now you've put me in a position of arguing that there are going to be flaws that are found, and I'm not saying that. I just don't want people to see it as just completely God-breathed, to use some other denominations.
This is not scripture.
That's
right. But you're not going to have it suddenly turning up that, what do you know, the organizational meeting to found the church was actually held in Maui. Or in the spring of 1820, Joseph Smith was marauding off the Barbary Coast as a pirate.
I think he's just thinking of his Hawaiian shirt.
Yeah.
Right now.
Although there are arguments about where the church was founded.
Oh, there are.
A story
there are, but Maui isn't one of them.
Maui isn't one of them. But your point well taken. This is a fabulous history. I don't want to throw rocks at it. Superbly done.
The other comparison would be the Mountain Meadows Massacre book that Oxford came out with a few years ago. Well, maybe it's 10 now. I don't know. But apparently that had three authors. And when I talked to the Oxford people, they said that it just took a long time to put together because of all the different authors, and they had different writing styles that had to be synthesized. And it was a challenge. Apparently this has been a much smoother process. And maybe they learned some things from that. I don't know.
It's amazing. So go out and read it.
There you go.
Sit down and read it. It's right there on your computer screen. So it's as easy, if you're thinking to yourself, how do I find this, as typing in LDS, history, saints. I mean, you'll find it. It's just super easy. You'll just get it anywhere. If you go to LDS.org or do a Google or a Bing search. If you hate Google, whatever you want to do, just you can find it. It's very simple to find. Next topic. Do you want to talk about the expanded canon, or do you want to talk about the BYU New Testament commentary?
We have about 10 minutes or so. What would fit into that?
The BYU New Testament.
I think the
commentary
because it had, the fourth volume hasn't come out yet, and we're not able to do that. And a few years ago, in fact, I've got a blurb on the back of the Revelation volume, and I took a little criticism in the Bloggernacle because of my promotion of this project. And one of the things that my response always is what has come before? Nothing. This is a great first step, and the project even admits when somebody comes along that wants to cover the same topic but in a different way, they may release it depending on their editorial standards. None of these volumes are set to change. It'll be just like the Anchor Bible. The Anchor Bible, we're waiting for a new Genesis volume, two volumes supposedly from Ron Hendel of Berkeley, and that may not be a good thing, but E.A. Spicer is the one that wrote it back in 1963, and that's the one that's still there 50 years later. So obviously with new discoveries, including the Dead Sea Scrolls and other things, they're going to have a replacement volume. And so that's going to be something that the BYU New Testament Commentary does, but it's still in its youth. It's only been out 2 or 3 years. So this is a project that I'm super excited about. I've interviewed the other authors of the other volumes previously on air, and it's been a great experience. Michael Rhodes and Draper.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Draper did the first volume that came out, which was Revelations, and then it was put to a lot of critical review on various panels and various things, and even I believe the Maxwell Institute had an issue of their antiquities study that was very critical of that. And when I interviewed Richard for his Corinthians volume, he said that had been a very positive experience, and they had incorporated some of what they felt was the valid criticism into their preparation of the Corinthians volume. So these things are kind of fluid, and I just think it's fantastic that they're doing this. I do have some concerns about the project, primarily because of a lack of tenure support from BYU, for lack of a better word. And it's a very risky project for a young scholar whose career may depend on it. I'd love to do one if I felt competent to do it, but my professional career as an attorney or whatever it is I'm doing doesn't depend anything upon my ability to write a commentary on the New Testament. And I think that two professors with me probably can be a little more sensitive to that. But this is a project that's just fabulous, especially for somebody that really wants to learn the scriptures.
I'm going to jump in here a little bit. First, on the tenure support, there, it's sort of a mixed bag, because on the one hand, if you want a commentary from somebody who's seasoned and experienced, and therefore somebody who doesn't have tenure yet, probably isn't seasoned or experienced enough that you'd want them writing a commentary. That's just from the, say, a publisher point of view. So it's the fact that there isn't, so to speak, tenure support on that. And I think it would really depend on the department as well. I don't know that there isn't, I don't know that it counts against you.
It might in some places.
In certain fire departments, it might. In certain police departments, it might not. But I don't know that that should particularly be an issue or concern. It's an ambitious project. It's it's an interesting project. There are lots of things that you can do. I think probably my problem is with commentaries in particular. What the commentator finds interesting and wants to talk about isn't always the thing that the reader is interested in finding out about. And that's a problem with commentaries. It's just a general one.
It is a landmark, though. I got in trouble for saying this a few years ago. I described Kent Brown's volumes on Luke as a sort of landmark in LDS scholarship, and several people went after me on that. It simply is because there's been nothing like it before. We've never had a real commentary on Luke or any other of the Gospels. And frankly, this is a minor consideration, but I used to be involved in putting on displays, designing displays that were held at the American Academy of Religion/Society of Biblical Literature annual meeting. And people would come by and they'd look at all this Mormon stuff, which is what we were putting out, or LDS stuff or whatever it is now, and they'd say, well, don't you do the Bible? Now that's kind of a reaction I had not anticipated. We sort of had turned that over to everybody else, you know, if the evangelicals and the Jews or whoever, what other group wants to do a commentary on a biblical book. We'll use that for our particular purposes, but we weren't doing our own biblical commentaries. And that led to a perception that sort of reinforced the perception in some circles we're not really Christian.
Gee, there's a pretty good Bible commentary called the Interpreter Bible Commentary.
That's right. We didn't do that one.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's not Mormon Interpreter.
No, it isn't. But the point is, there are some great scholarly works. As a matter of fact, one of my favorite Bible commentaries is their one volume, because it's in all the stuff they've just thought really hard about.
What's
how do
important?
You get the most important
stuff?
Yeah,
you know, one of the reasons that, you know, Mormon Interpreter is not actually the name of the organization, or, you know, but it's used sometimes because the word interpreter is so generic that if you just Google interpreter, you get, you know, language journals, things for professional, you know, simultaneous translators, so on. So online, the thing is called Mormon Interpreter, and some people refer to it that way in order to distinguish it from all the other conceivable and real interpreters that are out there.
Yeah, Dan thought about but discarded the idea of changing the website to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints Interpreter Foundation. But we kinda, you know, it's just a lot of typing, and so, you know. It's,
well, one thing, though, that is intriguing. When Bruce McConkie years ago did his four-volume Mortal Messiah, he took some criticism because he only went with the 19th century or Victorian era commentaries that were in use. Farrar and Edersheim is the other one. And in talking to one of his sons, who's a friend of mine, the reason he did that is during the 60s and 70s, biblical commentaries were primarily non-believing. That has changed. Nearly all of the major commentaries, maybe some of the German ones with exception, are promoted by evangelicals or Catholics or Protestants or Lutherans or something, even Jews, that are believing, that are more faithful in nature. Now, that's not universal, but there's a lot more available to that than that.
Well, you mentioned earlier Ronald Hendel, who is definitely not a believer.
Oh, I know that.
The Genesis, redoing the Genesis commentary for Anchor Bible, which is interesting, because the Anchor Bible commentary for Deuteronomy, which still hasn't been finished, is being finished by David Seeley, who is a member of the church. And so there's a variety out there.
There you go. You are listening to the Interpreter Radio Show on AM 1640. In studio, we have Dan Peterson, Carrie Hutchinson, John Gee, and me. I'm Martin Tanner. We'll be right back on the other side of this break. Stay tuned.
Now, the Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
We're back. This is the second hour of Interpreter Radio. The Interpreter Foundation is a nonprofit, 501c3, which defends the LDS faith, is involved in historical scholarship and defending the church against critics and all kinds of related things. Dan, you want to add a few words here about all of the different projects that the Interpreter Foundation is involved in, or maybe the ones you think are particularly pertinent, because you would know that better than anyone else in the room here.
Well, the main function that Interpreter does is to publish one article a week, or sometimes two, or in a few cases, three articles on a given Friday. I've lost track. It's 350 weeks in a row, Fridays in a row, where we've come out. We started off with the idea of publishing an article every week for 2 or 3 weeks, and then they just began coming in, and so we've never missed a week in the past 6+ years. So it's pretty amazing. That's the basic function. We've done a complete cycle of scripture roundtables, which, Martin, you were instrumental in organizing. That may be starting up again, I think.
We should do that.
Yeah. And I think Jeff Bradshaw, who's now back from the Congo, kind of wants to get involved in
that.
Of course, this radio program, but we've done scripture, Old Testament, Know-Wise. We've done some videos, lectures, conferences on science and Mormonism and so on. So it's a wide-ranging operation and done almost entirely by volunteers, which is pretty remarkable.
Don't forget the books.
And the books, yes. There have been several books. And I might mention, by the way, that we're co-sponsoring an event coming up on the 25th of September. I'd encourage everybody to mark your calendar. The 25th of September, I think it's a Tuesday, where Royal Skousen and Stan Carmack are going to be introducing the latest two-book volume in their in Royal's Book of Mormon Critical Text Project. It's The Nature of the Original Language of the Book of Mormon. This one's going to be kind of controversial because they're arguing that there are elements of early modern English in the Book of Mormon that are difficult, if not impossible, to explain in any way I can think of. Archaic verbal uses, archaic syntax, and so on. And these are a couple of really premier, well-trained linguists. So it's going to be an interesting evening, and the books will be extremely interesting. And there are a lot of people mocking them so far, you know, but it's typically because they actually haven't read what Skousen and Carmack, it's easier that way. They haven't read what they've written, and so make fun of them. But it's serious stuff with serious evidence.
Well, if somebody's criticizing what they're doing before it actually comes out, that's the shoot the messenger before you even have a chance to look at the message.
Well, these are meticulous linguists.
Yes.
And, you know, you ask, well, what is your theory to explain what you're finding? And they'll tell you, our job is to lay out what we've found. You know, how to explain it, we don't necessarily know, but it's there and you can't deny it.
So it's not in the late Great War of 1812 or whatever
No,
that
it is,
is
not. That won't explain it or account for it. So
you had something? No. One of the conversations that I've had a few times with Royal Skousen is the theory about exactly where the language for the text of the Book of Mormon came from. And it's a fascinating question, and people tend to polarize it and say every word came from God. And you have the Martin Harris's and David Whitmer's of the world say, oh, Joseph looked in the hat in the seer stone and he just read it. He read it letter by letter, word by word, and then it was written down by a scribe. On the other hand, how in the world would Martin Harris and David Whitmer know, because they weren't the guys looking in the hat, and I don't think Joseph Smith ever told him. On the other hand, if it really happened that way, why would Joseph Smith feel free to be able to go back and tinker around with and smooth out language in the original manuscript and in the printer's manuscript? He wouldn't, if he felt it was sacrosanct and every word was from God, he never would have done that. And so you've got to conceive of a divine component in this process, but also some kind of a human component from Joseph Smith himself that could be improved upon.
Except the problem is that the language that he's using isn't one that he particularly knows well. And it's not King James English. Where does he get it from?
Where does he get it from?
And it's weird, not that we have an explanation for why is it in early modern English, but it means that it's not Joseph Smith's language.
Yeah.
That's a problem.
Well, and you of course have that with the untranslated words and all the gazillions. Of course, that's not a real number. But, you know, the large number of new words, personal names, place names that he came up with. Well, that's not the right phrase either, but that are in the Book of Mormon. And, John, you're comment is very well taken. There really is no explanation for the text of the Book of Mormon that takes it all into account satisfactorily for everyone. At least I haven't come up with one.
No. You know, I've said that, you know, for Latter-day Saints, this is a weird finding that there's this early modern English in the Book of Mormon. It's puzzling to us, but for a non-Latter-day Saint, I think it's got to be exceptionally puzzling because there doesn't seem to be any natural avenue by which Joseph gets access to that kind of English. You could say, oh, it's King James. No, there are specific features of early modern English that are in the Book of Mormon, especially the original text, that are not in the King James. They're demonstrably early English, and almost every grammatical error in the Book of Mormon you can find was accepted usage for Oxford and Cambridge professors at the period
at
of early
time,
modern English.
Correct, yeah.
We
was there.
Yeah,
we,
yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's one of these unexplained inexplicable things about the Book of Mormon. Maybe somebody will come up with a good explanation, but that hasn't happened so far.
No. It'll be fun to see people try.
Yeah.
It's always fun to see people try. And isn't that sort of the crux of the whole conundrum that critics come up with? We were talking during the break about the whole issue of the plates. So not only do you have the issue of the plates, and I guess you might fudge and come up with some weird theories about, well, you know, Joseph Smith made the plates, or everybody was somehow
deluded,
hypnotized, mm-hmm. and they all thought they were, I don't know, you come up with weird theories. But the text of the Book of Mormon, we've got it, we've got the manuscripts, or at least portions of them. How do you explain their existence? That is a fascinating question.
I actually, that you bring this up, I'm always impressed with Martin Harris's testimony at one point on the Book of Mormon and the existence of the plates, because before he became one of the scribes, he hefted the plates in the box, and he said he knew from the heft, and you know, this is a New England farmer, I knew from the heft that they were either of gold or of lead, and I knew that Joseph Smith didn't have the credit to buy so much lead.
Certainly not gold.
Yeah. Yeah. I've always wondered if you meant that to be funny or if it's just unintentional.
Well, it
sure
could have been real.
True.
He gave him $50 to move from Pennsylvania to New York, and then he funded the publication.
Yeah.
I've always viewed these kind of things as in two ways. One is what I call the internal things, and the other is the externals. And there are both that are a combination. And when it comes to whether it's the Book of Mormon, whether it's the Book of Abraham, whether it's any aspect, there are internal consistencies between ancient documents that are inexplicable. There may be, as we see now, some other language elements that are inexplicable. There are unanswerable questions in certain respects about external. And the external is, well, let's take a good example, the witnesses. You know, we were talking off the air, and about a month ago, we got word that Richard Anderson had passed away. A great scholar, a really good man. He had been in our stake presidency when I was a BYU student, and I've read his devotional work. I've read his scholarly work for decades, and it was a great loss. He was a hard worker. He worked on the Joseph Smith papers. He had a little office there on the fifth floor of the Harold Bealey Library. I saw him there just a few months ago. Before he died, he was still working away and very active. And one of the things he was noted most for was his work on the three witnesses. After I did that program in the middle of August, I discovered that Scott Fallring had died. And I had heard for years that Scott Fallring was working on a documentary history of Oliver Cowdery and some other projects involving the witnesses. I'd hoped we would see a full-length biography of Oliver Cowdery by now. We haven't. And with the passing of Scott Fallring and the passing of Richard Anderson, I'm just kind of curious if we're going to see one. But even if we don't, I think the three witnesses and the physical nature of the plates, as evidenced by their discussion that we'll get to in a few minutes with, you know, and Tavis and the expanded canon. Richard Bushman also talks about the physical nature of them. Terrell Givens is quoted heavily. And those are two things that really need more explanation, but I've yet to see a satisfactory explanation that's against what is on its face, that there were physical plates and that there were three witnesses who saw the plates and the angel and all of the other things that were shown in that vision that is published in the Book of Mormon itself. Those physical evidences have yet to be satisfactorily challenged, in my opinion.
One of the things I'm most pleased about the work of the interpreter is we've done a couple of films and so on. We're working on a big film now. This is a massive one. So, again, I'm going to make the appeal. If any of you have a spare million or something, this is going to cost about $1.2 million. Of course, we expect smaller donations and hope for them. We don't expect anyone to come forward and pay for the whole thing. But as we've gotten some money in, we've been doing interviews. We've interviewed Ann Taves. We've interviewed Richard Bushman, Susan Easton Black, Terrell Givens, you know, various people like that. And
Richard Anderson.
Yeah, and I was going to get to Richard Anderson. The thing that I'm most pleased about is that sensing, you know, I mean, he was 92 roughly when he died, and so I knew that it was imperative that we get him fairly soon. So we spent 2 days interviewing Richard last summer, I think, or last spring, and so we have hours of interviews with Richard in the can that will make it into the film, but more than that, we'll use them. The nice thing now is that when you do filming, when you do interviews, you don't just throw away whatever doesn't fit the ultimate film. It used to be it ended up on the cutting room floor and that's it. You just don't use it. Nowadays with digital things, you don't have to do that. So we can take little bits of it that don't fit into the film and use them as freestanding apps. Richard Anderson speaking on this or on that. And so we've got, I don't know, probably 6 hours or so of interviews with Richard Anderson. Will be part of this film.
You put them at the end and after the, titles going down. Right. You know, you can have
Richard put them in the credits.
That's not what I meant. Oops. I'll redo. Let me say that.
Yeah. Yeah, we knew we had to get him. If you're doing a film on the witnesses with Richard alive, you had to interview Richard, who was the preeminent authority by light years on the witnesses.
If anyone listening has not read his book on the witnesses, it is just a masterpiece. And it's not long. It's just incredibly well done.
It's called The Investigating Book of Mormon Witnesses.
Yeah, I was sitting once at the back of an unusually boring gospel doctrine lesson, and so I admit that I was sort of cradling a copy of Investigating the Book of Mormon Witnesses on my lap and rereading it. And a friend of mine, Kent Jackson, who taught religious education at BYU for many, many years, just retired, came walking in. He was on the high council, and he came walking in and sat down next to me and said, "What are you reading?" And I showed him, and he said, he said, "Next to the scriptures themselves, that's the most faith-promoting book I have ever read."
Oh, that's fascinating.
I thought that was a good comment to make.
That is a great
comment.
So
Richard L. Anderson, Investigating the Book of Mormon Witnesses, still in print, still available.
And then I would add that Scott Fallring wrote a book, or an article, excuse me, called The Return of Oliver Cowdery.
Yes.
And I think back in 2006, Farms did a collection of articles about Oliver Cowdery that so far, for me at least, is the most we have on him. And that, to me, could form the basis of a biography. And that book made me emotional, reading it when Cowdery returns to the church after having been excommunicated, been gone for 10 years, and then he speaks to the saints shortly before he dies, before they go west. Just a very, very touching rendition of his return to the church.
He had arguments with Joseph Smith, but not with his testimony about the place. We'll be right back. This is the Interpreter Radio Show. We are back. This is Interpreter Radio. We have our first caller of the evening. So before we jump back into our topic, caller, you're on the air. Your name and your question or comment.
Yeah, this is Thomas Rogers in Bountiful.
Thank you for joining us.
I understand you said Scott passed away.
That's what I'd heard sometime late June, I believe it was. And I had also heard that he'd had a stroke previously. I don't know any of the details.
Oh, okay. That's a shame.
The stroke was quite a few years ago, actually.
Brother Anderson, too?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Brother Anderson passed away.
Let's see, now that's Richard, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Let's see, they were working on, well, Scott was working on Joseph Smith, American Prophets Record. I actually was given a bootleg copy before it was released, so I got to work with Scott and Richard, debate some items in there too. That's too bad. I had no idea Scott passed away. So was
June 29th of this year.
And he died with a stroke or stroke?
I think the stroke happened earlier is what Dan was saying.
Yeah, it was quite a few years ago. It was tragically young.
Let's see, do you remember how I'm trying to remember how old, he's not that old.
He was born in 1956. So
oh,
he
he's
would
a
be
kid.
62. 62 when he passed away.
Well, that was the main thing. I just wanted to check on that because they were old friends, and I've been kind of disconnected that from them for the last 20 years. But then 92, 93, I was interacting with them a lot on papers. In fact, Robert Matthews and I were good friends. And, of course, Robert was the one who opened the door for the church to get access to the documents, papers, you know, even the Joseph Smith translation of the Bible. That was in the custody of the reorganized church, right? And it was Robert Matthews that went back and negotiated with them and was able to at least photocopy or copy off or transcribe out of the records that they had. And that actually is the basis for the footnotes that we have in the, in the current quad or current scriptures. If it hadn't been for Brother Matthews and of course with Robert and with Richard, I should say, and Scott Fowering, we would be still deficient a lot of wonderful records.
It sounds like you walked in a great circle of friends.
Yeah, they must have been desperate. They actually allowed me in.
Yeah, you're self-deprecating like I.
Well, I'd rather put myself down than have everybody else do it. I like to get ahead of the game, you know.
There you go.
If you're going to badmouth me, I want to badmouth me first.
Thank you for the call. Some great comments, and don't be a stranger. Have a good evening.
Yeah, that.
Sorry. I didn't know he was going to make another comment. Call back if you have another significant comment to make. That would be great. And if anyone listening would like to join us, give us a call, 801-254-1640, 801-254-1640, and you will be on Interpreter Radio, which is sponsored by the Interpreter Foundation. Dan Peterson, John Gee, Terry Hutchinson in studio with me, Martin Tanner. We've been talking a bit, gentlemen, about the Book of Mormon, but this discussion really comes about because we planned on, for this segment, talking about a book that has come out from Greg Cofford Books called Expanded Canon, the Expanded Canon. And the point of this book is to have a number of different essays. I think there are 13 altogether, 14 maybe. And they cover a whole bunch of fascinating subjects. And some of them I just really like. The first one, The Triangle and the Sovereign, talking about the way canons are perceived and what's authoritative in a church. Do you have inspiration? Do you have an authority figure speaking for Christ like the Pope or general authorities, and then scripture, and how do all those swirl together, and which one's more authoritative, things like that. It's a great section, and there are a number of others. So let's talk about the ones
you
that
know, the triangle you just mentioned, the third leg of that tripod, if you will, is personal inspiration and how those three interact and weigh. And David Holland, a scholar from Harvard Theological
Divinity School.
But anyway, this was a conference, I guess, that was held at UVU, one of the first, from their Comparative Mormon Studies program. This volume is edited by Blair Van Dyke, Brian Birch, and Boyd Peterson, all three of whom have contributions to the volume. And, you know, they've got some other good names in here. And when I say names, I mean people who've really done great scholarship in the past. We've got James Faulkner on the literal interpretation of Scripture. We've got Richard Bushman reading from the gold plates. Right after that, the Ann Tavis that we talked about briefly and may talk about again. David Bokovoy about the Book of Moses as a prophetic midrash. and pivotal publishing moments for the Book of Mormon by Paul Gutyar, who's the author of the Book of Mormon, a short biography for Princeton. You know, it's been interesting for me in the last 25 years as I've, you know, commented on books in general and Mormon books in specific, how our publisher has changed from the University of Illinois Press, which used to do what I thought was primarily the best work that was not produced by LDS publications, the most scholarly work on our history and on our other sociological aspects of our culture and other things like that, to now we're with Oxford, we're with Princeton, we're with Yale. It's just astounding. Harvard has done some. So I think that as our scholarship has improved, and I think a lot of that has to do, as I look at it, and this is just my opinion, with the influence of the Original Farms group and the Nibley scholars who have gone forward in many different areas. And then also people like John and like Dan going outside and getting their doctorates and coming back home and doing work not outside in their regular scholarly endeavors, but also contributing in other ways, actually putting in the time and the sacrifice. And so now we have a wide variety here. But this is just one example. I'm sure there will be others, and this is often something that's done. In fact, Interpreter Foundation has done that, where we've had conferences on ancient temples. I think we've had three of them, and then we put together a volume containing all the papers. And that's basically what this is, but it's got some really good stuff in it, and it's got a couple of clunkers, for lack of a better word. Is that an academic term, John?
Yes.
Oh, well,
clunkers.
Yeah. Sometimes I've heard it referred to as turkeys. But you have, this is not atypical for one of these collected volumes. Anytime you get a volume of collected papers, or almost any time, there are exceptions. There are rare exceptions where all of the papers are good. Most of the time you get a mixture. You get some really good ones, you get a couple of really bad ones, and then you get some mediocre ones, and that fills out a volume. Occasionally you get some that are all really good, and so that's just the way that a typical academic volume comes out.
I think that's what this is, though, really, is this is an academic volume, and some of the treatments in here are interesting, but it can be heavy going for some of it. I mean, you look at the Tavis article, for one thing. There are many original documentary citations. So, in other words, she's really trying to get to the heart of the physicality of the plates. And what I like about it is that Bushman's article talks about the physical nature of the plates in his article called Reading the Golden Plates. And then you have Ann Tavis, who has a very intriguing theory about that. And we talked a little about it off the air, but if I can simplify it, it's basically that most critics of the church discount all of the testimony or evidence about the physical nature of the plates. They discount Emma's statement about riffling the pages. They discount, as John was saying, Martin Harris's hefting the plates. They just don't pay attention to that. Now, Tavis, who's not LDS, can't quite bring herself, I think, to get to the place, okay, yeah, there were plates, so she says, well, there's not plates, but here's how I'm going to somehow come to the conclusion that Joseph was sincere in his mind. And a very intriguing theory for me was that based on the story of the brother of Jared in Ether, that Joseph somehow made something that was like the plates and then was able to pray to get the Lord to change it into the gold plates, or what was represented to be the gold plates, and everybody had the physical testimony about that. It was a little bit confusing to me. I usually can follow a fairly technical argument, but that one didn't quite get there for me.
The subtitle sort of tips you off if you read it and think about it. The subtitle is Joseph Smith and the Materialization of the Gold Plates, as if they somehow appeared out of nothing by some means.
Sort of like the transporter in, you know, Star Trek.
That's right.
I was actually thinking maybe that she has the idea that all these accusations of Joseph Smith practicing magic may have actually been true, maybe. He was conjuring them up out of midair. But in Joseph Smith's days, these accusations about magic and so forth, if you look at the way they use the language, this means all of these terms that are used for magic are synonyms for fraud. Mm-hmm. And so to say that something was magic was to say that it was a fraud. And Joseph Smith was practicing magic, which means that they were arguing in their terms that he was a fraud. And we have taken that and half-Disneyfied it.
It's fascinating to me that today people who don't believe in the LDS Church, those who are disbelievers, critics, whatever, they just flat out don't believe in the plates. And the thing that I find the most strange and ironic about that is that in Joseph Smith's time, even his most ardent critics believed the plates were real. As a matter of fact, all the people who were really angry with him were initially, the early people who just got really upset with him weren't so much upset with him over theological issues, although there were a few of those. It's because he wouldn't be business partners with him and help him peddle the plates or run him around in some show somewhere. They all believed they were real. They just...
They kept trying to steal them.
That's right. They kept trying. Yeah, it's, gee, Ann, how are you going to steal those metaphysical plates that don't really exist?
Well, I think that the position she's taking is an interesting one because she's almost surrendering on a couple of really important points. And this is a tribute maybe to how far LDS scholarship has come, including Richard Anderson's work and Scott Fowlering's, that it is no longer possible. There are evangelical anti-Mormons and others who will just flat out say, look, Joseph was lying, the witnesses were lying, or they were deluded, they were hallucinating, and so on. But the more you learn about them, the more you discover that Joseph was sincere. I mean, the evidence that he's sincere is really, really clear. And that the witnesses were sincere is very, very clear. And they were also not obvious lunatics. These are people who held public office before and after their experience as witnesses. They were esteemed highly by their neighbors. You have testimonials from their neighbors to their reputability and so on and so forth. So you're stuck with a problem, which is that you have 11 people, official witnesses, 12 if you had Joseph, who say there were literal physical plates. We saw them. In some cases, we held them. We hefted them. They were heavy. We heard the voice of God, we saw an angel, and so on. What do you do with that if you're eliminating the possibility that they're either crazy as loons or they're just flat out lying or victims of a conspiracy? They're dupes or dupers, if you will. And so to me, there have always been, well, three broad possibilities. I remember my friend Bill Hamlin at one point was having a discussion with a critic and said, so tell me, you say there weren't plates. Did Joseph know there were no plates, or did he not know there were no plates? If he knew there were no plates and said there were, then he was lying. If he didn't know it, he was crazy. Phil said, I don't want to get caught in your simplistic dichotomies. Well, those seem to me to be the options.
Those are the options.
Or else there really were plates and he was telling the truth. But,
that's right.
But Ann Tavis, I don't know how she says her name, is trying to find a different... You know, a way around that. Where you grant their sincerity, you grant their sanity, and yet there still were no Nephite plates. And I think that's a really hard thing to do.
It is. And in addition to those 11 official witnesses, you have Emma, who moved the plates around and talked about it and physically felt them, even though they were covered by the linen cloth. And you have a number of others who did so as well.
Yeah.
The Whitmers.
Well, you have Mary Whitmer.
Yeah.
And the older gentleman, Moroni, who showed her the plates.
Yeah.
In fact, that was something that was I found on the church website just the other night. My wife had never run across that story.
It's a great
and,
story.
And she said, I thought I knew all the stories. And it's right there as the church was rolling out this new history we've been talking about all night.
So what do you do with all these people? It's really tough to keep a lie together or a conspiracy together. It's a difficult thing to do.
Especially when you get so many of the witnesses who left the church, yeah, and were some of them were furious with Joseph Smith, and yet they still said, "Oh yes, but there were really plagues."
But there were really plagues. Yeah. Yep.
David Whitmer was as mad as could be at Joseph and at Brigham and so on. But did an angel speak up here before you? Yes. Did the voice of God testify? Yes. He insisted on it to his dying day, 1888.
This is the Interpreter Radio Show. We'll be right back after these messages. Stay tuned. We're back for the final segment of Interpreter Radio. I'm Martin Tanner. In studio with me, we have Dan Peterson, Terry Hutchinson, and John Gee. And this hour, we are going to talk about John's book that's come out recently, An Introduction to the Book of Abraham.
Okay. I'm ready.
here you are.
And fire the questions away, right?
And you know, John, as I mentioned earlier, isn't the guy who toots his own horn, so I'm going to do that at the beginning. This is the finest thing to date that has been done on the Book of Abraham. And in addition to it being a scholarly work, it has great depth and great background. And, of course, everything is very well documented. This is a readable book. You have accomplished something that the early history of the church failed to accomplish, as we were talking about earlier. I shouldn't make that joke, but the point is, this is a great book. It's something that anybody could read and get a lot out of, and it would not be over their head, and yet it's very scholarly.
And what is the name of it again?
An Introduction to the Book of Abraham. And you can get it at all fine bookstores everywhere. And you can get it at Barnes & Noble. You can get it at Deseret Book. You can get it at Amazon.com.
And you can get it at Fair Mormon.
Fair Mormon and a bunch of other places, too. An Introduction to the Book of Mormon by John Gee. An Introduction to the Book of Abraham by John Gee. That is G-E-E, if you...
Well, somebody ought to write one on the Book of Mormon, too. But,
yeah, Introduction to the Book of Mormon.
So we should explain to... An introduction is an academic genre, but it's the idea is that you introduce a work and the scholarship behind around that work to an audience that doesn't know about it. So it really... It's aimed at an audience that... Well, I assume that the reader didn't know anything about Egyptian and may not know much of anything about the church. And so I tried to explain it. I took out all of the jargon that you'd find in a typical book about Egyptology and tried to make it so that you can understand the issues and that... take you through them and take you up to where you feel like you know something about the subject. And yes, it is scholarly, and yes, scholars will learn something new from it, but don't be afraid of it because it's not that sort of book.
I would just add that it's readable to the layperson, my audience in particular. A lot of times the only thing they know about either the books or the authors or anything else that we talk about is what I tell them on their air until they go get it themselves. This is very readable. The question that kind of raises to me is, I know that you brought some of your Egyptology background into the book. But the question that I'd ask you is, how does this relate to, say, some of the later discoveries like the Apocalypse of Abraham or the Testament of Abraham, some of the pseudepigraphal work that wasn't even discovered until after Joseph Smith?
There is actually a chapter on that. So we talk about some of the later things that came up. Earlier we did a collection, the late John Twetness and I and Brian Hoglid put together a collection of over 100 ancient accounts about Abraham. We went up through about the medieval period, about Abraham and his early life, and did translations of all of those accounts. One of the accounts had never been published before, so we even published that text in the original in one of the appendices. And so we've been through that material. It's an interesting group set of material. It's got some nice parallels. It also has some really strange stuff in it. I think one of my favorites is some of the medieval, or not medieval, late antique Muslim accounts that have Abraham being launched into the fire from a catapult. And he has these long conversations with the angels while he's flying through the air towards being sacrificed in the fire, which when he lands turns into a whole bunch of flowers. It's a really interesting scene. I'm sorry to say I don't believe it, but and it doesn't really parallel the Book of Abraham all that closely, but it is an interesting account. We've got all of them there. And in this, so I'd spend a chapter discussing some of this material and what was known to Joseph Smith or what could have been known to Joseph Smith, and give an introduction to some of that material. But that's just one of many issues that are raised by the Book of Abraham that I discuss.
The parallel of his father's idol worship is something that comes up in the Apocalypse of Abraham in particular, and many other sources that I don't think were available to Joseph Smith.
Most of them weren't. When we did the larger scholarly study, if you will, which is called Traditions About the Early Life of Abraham, I think it's still available. It's quite expensive. You can find that on Amazon. That's the other thing that's nice about the introduction to the Book of Abraham, is that we wanted it to be reasonably priced, and I think it is. But when we did the larger study, we made sure that we put in all of the information about when the text was available in what language, so that if you want to see what was available to Joseph Smith, you can find out that most of it wasn't.
One of the things that people often ask about the Book of Abraham, and you talked about things that weren't available to him, there are items in here. You mentioned when we last spoke on the air about Olashem and about some other things that are just leap out from the text at somebody if they understand that that's a new discovery since Joseph Smith's lifetime. Do you want to talk about
one
and maybe a few others?
Actually, to me, that has been one of the more interesting aspects of my research recently is been looking in the last few years, is looking at how the Book of Abraham matches Abraham's day. Now that we know more or less when Abraham lived and more or less where, so we've got the general gist. We now know, and this has been since the year 2000, this has come out, that the Egyptians were in up in the Levant and Lebanon and to the western end of modern Syria, and it's a short period of time, no more than 50 years when they were up there, and it's, you can limit it to the reign of basically two pharaohs in the Middle Kingdom. And so the description of Abraham chapter 1 of his interaction with the Egyptians has to take place in that time period. Now you can quibble, if you're into ancient chronology, about exactly what dates those correspond to. It was roughly about 1850 to 1800 BC. But that gives you a place and a time, and then we can start looking at bullseyes. Well, actually, the fact that we now know that the Egyptians were up there. 100 years ago, in 1912, there were Egyptologists who made fun of Joseph Smith for saying precisely that. But now we've got... We've got inscriptions, one of them which was published in 2008, about this new Egyptian inscriptions that talks about the Egyptian army going up there in the reign of one of those pharaohs and taking over Byblos. And right at that time in Byblos, now that we've excavated archaeologically in the last century, we know that they suddenly changed to, for two generations, the rulers of Byblos no longer called themselves king. They're suddenly, with Egyptian hieroglyphs, describing themselves as governors.
So you have the right time frame, the location is proven.
The location is, well, it's not narrowed down nearly as much as we'd like for archaeology, location. But the general location is known. It's going to be roughly southern Turkey, northern Syria. One of the proposed sites is actually 2 miles from the border. And all of this has come out in really the last less than 20 years. And so, and then we discuss that in the book, and so we can talk about what things were like in Abraham's day. We can talk about, there's some things when you start looking at the documents there, about land transfers that figure into the promises that God makes to Abraham about the land is mirrored in covenant contracts of that time period. The form of the covenant that's given to Abraham in Abraham chapter 2, in 2012, there was this massive volume that analyzed all of those treaties and said, well, they have specific forms and covenants, and they have specific forms and specific times. The one in Abraham 2 matches first half of the second millennia BC and no other time.
I remember when you first announced that at a conference on the BYU campus, and I was really excited because it seemed to me it was sort of a watershed moment, if you will, that this was one of the first times where we weren't using ancient evidence to try to legitimate the Book of Abraham. We were using the Book of Abraham to help pin down a vexing question in ancient history, namely the date of Abraham. That the Book of Abraham had something to contribute to the question. This is the reverse of the way we normally have thought about these things. And I thought, now, that is really interesting. When a text makes a prediction, you know, think in terms of Karl Popper and his philosophy of science, the text makes a prediction, and in fact the evidence then eventually comes to bear that prediction out.
And that was a really interesting thing, because if you go from the Bible, you get a wide range of dates and places for Abraham, and the Book of Abraham helps you pinpoint that much better than the Bible does.
Yeah.
So it really does help establish the historicity of Abraham much better than the Bible does.
I thought that was an exciting moment. I still remember that and thinking, oh, now this is interesting. This is a different direction of argument than we've normally had.
So in the last couple of minutes, I was wondering if John had any responses to any of the reviews or any of the comments that have been coming out since his book came out. Because a lot of times, you know, scholar puts a book out, then there's some scholars who take exception to that or have different theories, and they go out, and then eventually, you know, you kind of have a response. So I'm wondering if there's been any of that. This book has been out almost a year now, and so there's been plenty of time for people to gather up or marshal whatever their feelings or ideas are about the book.
Well, most of the reviews that I've seen have been very positive. I thought Stephen Smoot was very kind when he said that that I was one of the few people alive who could probably write this whole book myself, given all the different areas that Book of Abraham research gets into. That was very flattering. And I appreciated the comment, because it's not easy to do good Book of Abraham research. You're dealing with, on the one hand, Ptolemaic Egypt, you're dealing with church history, you're dealing with Abraham's world, which is almost any one of those fields requires a lot of specialties, but this one, putting them together is hard to do. But we did it.
But we did it. Congratulations. The book and Introduction to the Book of Abraham. fabulous book by author John Gee. I highly recommend it. This has been the Interpreter Radio Show.